Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you are in the world and what time it is when you're tuning in. This is Perrin Desports, and I'm your host for the Group Practice Accelerator podcast from Polaris Healthcare Partners. If you're an entrepreneurial dentist or physician, and you're interested in building a successful group practice, you found your primary resource for some of the industry's best business education. My partner, DeWalker Sinha, and I have decades of experience helping people just like you launch, scale, and ultimately exit successful group practices. In short, we create clarity, confidence, and results. Welcome, everybody, to yet another episode of the Group Practice Accelerator podcast, one where I am going to give you a bit of a deeper explanation around an article that recently appeared in Dental Economics. Judging from some of the outreach that I got from some of you via text, phone call, and email, I might have kicked over a little bit of an anthill. If I did, I'm certainly not going to walk it back. I'm going to give you some insights into what that article is around the M&A markets, how to think about it, and what it might mean for your business as you look forward into the next 12, 24, even 36 months. You know, it'll be a note-taking episode, so get your pad and pen ready. My Mila coffee maker is definitely operational today, so brew another wonderful cup for yourself. The Group Practice Accelerator podcast is on the air. And welcome, everybody, once again to the Group Practice Accelerator podcast. Thank you for a little bit of time this morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you may be and whatever you may be doing. I certainly appreciate you being in the audience, which, judging by the download numbers, continues to grow. I think we've set some records in the last couple of weeks, at least as it relates to overall downloads over about a monthly basis, which is the number we look at. And I'm very grateful for all of you who recommend the show to your colleagues and friends, maybe even share an episode to help us broaden the reach of what we talk about and the philosophies we share. And when the numbers keep kind of ticking up and up and up, it's really reassuring to know that we're providing content that is valuable to so many of you in the audience and so many who will be joining our audience. I'm grateful for that. We don't really advertise and promote the podcast that much. So really, most of our growth in the podcast is what I would call organic. And that comes from so many of you. So just a word of gratitude and thanks for not only being in the audience, but, you know, being an advocate for us. DeWalker and I and our entire team here at Polaris are truly grateful for that. So let me get right into it. We were asked to write an article for Dental Economics, a widely read publication and has been for a number of decades now. It's really, as the title suggests, more around the business side of dentistry. And it's they always have some cool insights and some things in there. And I think you've been, you know, following some of the guidance that we've been giving both operationally and from an M&A standpoint. And recently authored an article that appeared in both the online publication and the print publication. The print publication may not be out yet, but the online publication sure is. And it was around kind of a state of affairs as it relates to M&A, generally speaking, but obviously targeted at dentists and the dental industry. And as publications are wont to do, they pull some of the juicy stuff out and use that as the banner ads, so to speak. And one of the quotes that they took was around the M&A bubble being about to burst in dentistry. And I'm going to be honest with everybody in the audience. There's only limited words and space in these articles. And you know from being a listener to this show that that DeWalker and I tend to go deep into subject matter, and we tend to explain a lot of things with a lot of facts and history and experience that we both bring to the industry. I think that's what y'all like, and it's why you come back and listen very often. In written format, that's a little more challenging to do. And even when you do have unlimited space, you have to, sometimes it's more challenging to relate deeper concepts in written format if you don't have truly unlimited space. And that was what we were dealing with there. So let's talk the world of M&A for a second. And let's maybe clarify a couple of things, but I'm not going to walk back anything on that, because I think what we shared was maybe different from what most of what you hear in the sell side advisory market, people fanning the flames and everything like that. And ours tends to come from a little more holistic standpoint, especially as it relates to our consulting nature and the consulting side of our business. So how do we start out here on you know, some of the fundamentals, if you will, to kind of reset and give you a little bit more color in between the lines? Let's talk about the fundamentals of the practice of dentistry for a second. And this would include, for those who are non-dentists in our audience, other physicians and healthcare service providers. This is not too dissimilar from many other healthcare services businesses. But for the world of dentistry specifically, a dental practice is a wonderful blend of fixed and variable costs. All right. And that's why it's so attractive to so many investors, as you well know, that after you clear the fixed costs of the business and can generate more revenue above and beyond that, progressively more and more profitability drops to the bottom line. It's a wonderful case study of a small business as it relates to both fixed and variable costs. Some healthcare services businesses have even less of a fixed cost structure to it. Some have slightly greater. But the bottom line here is that the more revenue you can drive through these businesses is the more profitability you can generate and margin expansion on an incremental basis. That's the same for a single location as it is for a handful of locations, to a regional group, to an enterprise level DSO. The principles are really no different. But when you look at other businesses, other sectors of the world, some are not structured as advantageously as healthcare services businesses are. So fundamentally speaking, it's a great business model. That's the first takeaway. Even though all of you probably own and operate one, you probably don't think about the model itself from a comparative standpoint that often, because it's probably the only model you've ever known. And that's okay. But I'm here to tell you that, you know, healthcare services businesses are pretty good businesses to own and operate. And I think we would all testify to that. So let's talk about, you know, the fundamentals of healthcare services and dentistry specifically a little bit more, you know, in the aggregate, I would say. The fundamentals of healthcare services, and certainly dentistry is part of this, are highly advantageous. And what I mean by that is almost from a patient level or a consumer driven standpoint. So are people living longer or shorter lives going forward? We all know they're living longer. You know, that driven by the baby boomer population that's now pretty much all retired, they have more disposable income at their fingertips, and that is a generation that is more predisposed to spend money on looking pretty, so to speak, and doing things certainly that continue to promote greater life longevity. All right. So the mindset of not just the segment of current or recent retirees, but even those that are still in the workforce, is that all of us spend more money on things that help us improve our lives and sustain our lives and give us greater hope for longevity in the future. And the actuarial tables bear that out, and the consumer tables around where people spend money bear all that out. So I'm not probably telling you anything that you don't know. But one thing that would corroborate this is that healthcare services sectors are always in the top three areas of investment criteria for private equity groups. All right. So this, everybody in this audience who's listening to this podcast right now, who is a healthcare services provider, be it dentist or any type of physician, you're in a highly advantageous space because people are living longer and they're demanding more of your services. And for that reason, it draws the attraction of outside investment. Okay. And this is the healthcare services have been in the top three investment criteria of private equity funds for multiple decades now. This is not a recent phenomenon. And for those of us in dentistry, that this really started exploding, you know, a few years before the pandemic, it's still not a recent phenomenon. Even though we may recognize it as being more recent in dentistry, our physician brothers and sisters will testify that it's been around for a while. All right. So I don't think any of that's going to change. So if we think about the business model of dentistry and healthcare services practices, it's a great business model. It has a lot of advantages to it. And dentistry specifically doesn't suffer from a lot of the government payer challenges of some of the other healthcare service models. And that is a further testament to the attraction of the dental industry overall. We also know that people are living longer and demanding those services. So that it's not like the demand for services is in decline or is forecasted to be in decline. Quite the contrary. People are spending more for longer on healthcare services. That's a huge thumb up, if you will. And then from an investment standpoint, you know, as it relates to the industries overall that we focus on, you know, dentistry specifically is still relatively unconsolidated. We think about the proliferation of DSOs and other verticals, MSOs, and there are some other healthcare verticals that are more consolidated, certainly general surgery and the like. But you know, as it relates to dentistry, I know everybody thinks private equity owns every practice and they're at 90 to 100% consolidation, but that's just not the case. It's probably closer to somewhere between 30 and 40% of the entire market. And when you think about private equity backed groups, even though there's so many of them, and even though in an aggregated form, they may own 30 to 40% of all the practices, no one entity of a private equity backed sector really has more than a couple of percentage points of market share. Heartland Dental is the largest group in our world, obviously, and they're, I don't know, maybe 1,800 to 2,000 practices or something like that, probably not quite 2,000 yet. But you think about the total share of dental practices out there, and it's still a very small number. So we don't have market dominance by any one entity, and we don't even have a majority share by private equity-backed groups aggregated yet. All right. So just because traditional solo practice dentistry makes up less than 50% of the total population doesn't mean that consolidation has run its course and that it is all said and done. Quite the contrary. We've got a long road to go ahead of this. So that is attractive from an investor standpoint because the business model is solid at a clinic level, and the demand for services is forecasted to continue growing by people living longer. That's a huge positive. And you still have more than half of the industry, probably about two-thirds of it, that is not private equity backed. So there's tremendous opportunity for further consolidation, further revenue synergies, further cost synergies, further economies of scale. And all of that is dramatically positive on a go-forward look. All right. So when we say bubble is bursting or is about to burst or has burst, what does that really mean? Like, what's the context behind it? And why is that more of a multi-layered answer versus, headline grabbing sensationalism, if you will? Well, if you listen to a lot of sell-side advisory firms, they are in the business of selling practices in groups. That's how they get paid. We have a sell-side advisory arm at Polaris. We get paid the same way to transact businesses. However, that is not our only business or only side of our business. You all know that we do a lot with associate partnerships and executive partnerships, buy-in and earn-in equity models. You know that we do a lot with consulting services, growth strategy. We do a lot with debt recapitalization and credit facility for those who want to grow with a more longer-term lending partner. You know that we do call center consulting for those wanting to build a platform. I mean, and on and on and on. Ours is a multifaceted business that is not uniquely oriented towards sell-side advisory. For those that are uniquely oriented towards sell-side advisory, it does them no good to say that the market is cooling or stalling or that the bubble is burst. That would be, to communicate something like that, it would be bad for their business because it would be a wet blanket on the activity that drives their results and their income. All right, so let's understand for a second when we hear people say the market's white hot, multiples that are an all-time high, you need to get in while the getting's good, all that kind of other stuff. You know, I'm sure that's what they're seeing at some level, but it's also to a degree self-serving. Look, if you're interested in transacting your business, I would hope that you would think that Polaris is a credible entity and that you would want to talk with us to see if we're the right fit for you. It goes without saying that's part of our business and a part of our business that we take a lot of pride in. That being said, I think what we're all guilty of is evaluating the valuation levels of the business of dentistry as being the norm of what we've seen in the last couple of years since coming back from the pandemic. Even leading up to the COVID pandemic, we were seeing a pretty rapid rate of transactions and also a rapid rate of private equity recaps. And that, you know, recap cycle was being compressed into probably 3 to 5 years on a whole time, whereas it's normally in the 4 to 7, 5 to 8 year range. All right. So the velocity of the recaps were happening at a very, very fast rate. When you came out of COVID, you had, very low cost of debt funds. And we know that all private equity groups use debt funds of one size and shape to get to make their invested equity dollar go further. So they were borrowing a lot of money at a very, very low rate, and they were acquiring a lot of practices and small groups for arguably a turn or two higher on a multiple as it relates to valuation based on something called pro forma EBITDA. All right. So when you establish the valuation of a business, it is usually historical in nature with some forward-looking considerations, right? But what we saw coming out of COVID, when people could have, when larger entities were desiring to either enter the space of dentistry, or for those that were already in the space of dentistry, they were looking to aggregate market share. And the theory was that they can borrow a lot of funds that don't cost them that much. They can afford to overpay by a turn or two for assets, and they're going to make their money on a faster recap cycle, similar to what we saw pre-COVID levels. Okay. That creates what former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan would term back in the 90s, irrational exuberance. You have the rush of dirt cheap money into the sector. You have people that are not operationally disciplined that want to enter the sector and are simply going to aggregate practices. And you have some enterprise level groups that lost their acquisition discipline and overpaid for assets that they could not improve or operate. What does that mean? Well, when rates tick up quickly the way they have, most of the debt structure of those private equity entrants and private equity established groups, most of the debt structure is some level of a variable interest rate structure. So when rates go up, their cost of funds goes up. The second thing that happens is most of the lenders, be they banks or non-bank lenders, start to constrict the credit box that they're willing to operate in, because they don't want to take the risk on a debt structure piece. They don't want to take the risk of any looming default. So what that means is that when you might be able to, prior to the rise in rates, maybe the credit boxes were 5 to 6, you know, a ratio of 5 to 6 funded debt to EBITDA, five or six to one funded debt to EBITDA. Now they shrink back into a 3 to 4 times debt to EBITDA. And that is a significant reduction in available debt funds to acquire more practices. So the activity level of acquisitions goes down. There's just less available dollars sloshing around to buy practices. And then the second thing is, those who are in mid-stroke of whatever their growth strategy is of aggregating practices now sees the fact that they can't turn operational improvement in the businesses they've acquired. And lo and behold, the funds that they borrowed to buy those businesses that they couldn't operate and couldn't improve now cost them more. And that's creating dramatic margin squeeze at a practice level and certainly at an enterprise level. So we all know the rise in rates because we see that in things like mortgage rates or if we take on a car loan or something like that. Well, at a business level, it has an equally dramatic impact in a consolidating industry because it's going in the opposite direction of what it has historically. When we say the bubble has burst, what we mean is that those that were banking on a quick flip, an easy turn, simply borrowing a lot of money, acquiring a lot of assets, and flipping it at some short period of time and letting somebody else sort it out, that bubble has burst. That's the aggregator bubble. It is no longer where we stand. It was arguably a very bad thing for the industry. And I think it makes all of us focus more on operations. Makes all of us focus on more true business development, to improve profitability, to take costs out of businesses, to generate revenue, to do all the fundamentals that we all have to do as solo practice owners. That's a healthy thing. It's a healthy thing for people building businesses because it resets some of their expectations around chasing easy money, but it also at an enterprise level forces those operating these businesses to dig down deep into a clinic level to be more certain of the assets that they are acquiring and just what they're willing to pay for them. And of course, we're seeing that in the M&A markets right now. We have some very high value businesses that are looking for a private equity type of a partner. And I would tell you, And my partner DeWalker Sinha would echo this in spades, I'm sure, that the due diligence phases are dramatically more thorough and longer lasting. The people who are writing big checks are still willing to write big checks. They're still willing to pay high multiples for quality assets, but they want to make darn sure what they're paying is what they're going to get in the future. And the last piece around valuation is that many of the, when we talk about valuation multiples in the industry, a lot of them were inflated on what's known as a pro forma EBITDA basis, meaning when somebody was looking to acquire an asset, they were looking at certainly the current levels of EBITDA, but they were really forecasting what they wanted to value the business on as a multiple of forward-looking EBITDA. Like what does the business hold in terms of upside potential in the next 2 to 3 years? And how do we wrap our head around that as it relates to the valuation we're willing to pay for this particular asset? Now, you've got to prove that the business can operate and can sustain operations. And that is really more of a trailing 12 months EBITDA perspective, not a pro forma EBITDA perspective. And that is a significant shift in the marketplace itself. All of this has contributed to a lower level of activity in the M&A markets, which all makes perfect sense in my mind. And it is a return to normalcy as it relates to valuation multiples that we're seeing for businesses that are transacted. I think this is a healthy thing, honestly. I think that people were maybe deluded or I'm not sure what the word would be around what they were hearing their business was worth. It's kind of like somebody, you know, offering to buy. If your house values at $1 million and you have somebody ride up in your driveway and say, I'll offer you $1.8 million for your house, wouldn't that send an alarm bell off in your mind? Like, okay, what's wrong with you? Or exactly what do you mean by $1.8 million for an asset that's barely over half that? I mean, we would all be suspicious of that, right? Yet there weren't very many people doing the same for the value of their business as it relates to M&A transactions in the world of dentistry in the last couple of years. So I think this kind of return to normalcy, I don't want to say back to basics, but it's really operational perspective and certainly at a clinic level around revenue generation, cost containment, ultimately margin expansion, that's value creation. All right. And that's what makes businesses on a forward-looking basis a lot more valuable than they have been on a historic basis. So this sort of shift from aggregator to operator is something that we have talked about, and I've talked about on multiple podcasts, not just this one, but other ones that I've appeared on. I think it is, I don't want to say it's unfortunate, but there are definitely reasons for it. And I think in the more intermediate to longer term basis, it's going to be a very, very healthy thing for our industry overall. We're probably still sorting out some of the messes, and we're going to do that over the course of this year. But I certainly believe in the fundamentals of dentistry and the other healthcare services verticals that we operate in. So let's sort of pivot and look ahead for a second. And how do we want to think about the current state of affairs as it relates to M&A, but also just generally speaking, the businesses at hand? For one, we may be in some level of a little bit of economic uncertainty, and that's born out of where rates are right now, the specter of inflation, unemployment still being at very, very low levels, it's a presidential election cycle. So you throw that in there. And I mean, there's just a lot of kind of question marks in everybody's mind about where we end up. I get it. I also think that for those of us that are operating businesses and continue to focus on growth, this is a time to double down on your business, to control what you can, to get back to basics, certainly, to be an operator with an operator's mindset. And if now is the right time to find a capital partner, which could be a debt capital partner for growth to remain independent, or it could be a private equity type partner to bring some additional resources to the table in terms of leadership and, you know, access to available capital for the next phase of growth for your business, I think this is a really, really good time. But I think it's a time where you have to have realistic expectations for yourself, for your business, for the process involved to access that capital, and really be focused around execution in terms of driving value creation. And that's at a clinic level. And those that were just hoping to sell an asset for, you know, 50 to 100% over what it should be valued at and make some cheap money and cash a check and buy an island in the Caribbean, those days are probably in the past. You know, the business fundamentals of the industry are really, really solid. You're fortunate to be a healthcare services provider in the United States right now. Do you face certain headwinds? Well, yeah. You know, everybody does. Welcome to the club, right? It's no different running a services business like DeWalker and I do, candidly. But it is also the fact that y'all are a cut above as it relates to your academic acumen and your clinical skill set. And you are in a highly advantageous position because the business models you have are very sound and the barriers to entry are very high. I can't be a clinical dentist. If I want to be a clinical dentist, I got to go back to school. I got to, you know, pass the boards and do all that kind of stuff. The barriers are really high for me to do that. So, you know, as it relates to kind of the wall around what you do and the captive audience to a degree that you have, you're in a really, really good space. And I think this is a positive thing for the industry overall. And I don't want the specter of what's roiling the M&A markets to cloud your outlook for that. If now's the right time to transact the business and yours is a quality business that produces consistent levels of EBITDA and it has a high degree of continuity as it relates to patient care and all the other fundamentals that we talk about, it's going to value really highly. You know, you're going to be rewarded for the business that you built. It's not a bad thing to go through an extended due diligence phase and to pick the right partner for that. So I wanted to take a second on today's podcast, more than a second, to kind of explain what that article was and to maybe give a little bit more color than what I've been able to respond with as it relates to text messages and direct messages and phone calls and some other jazz. But this gives you kind of a more extemporaneous look from my lens and from our lens about the world of M&A, about our look to that world and the way we look at things positively, but also to a degree realistically. And I would also think that as we talk about a return to normalcy, if you're contemplating taking your business to the market in the next, I don't know, year to 2 years, you probably just want to think about that, not when you're ready to do it. You want to think about it ahead of time. And by that, it's probably 6 to 12 months. So if this is a conversation you're starting to have with yourself, bring in an advisor like one of us at Polaris to sit down and think through what that looks like. What are your expectations? What are your needs? What do you want life after the liquidity event to look like? What's your level of risk? You know, what is the business need that you can't provide it that you're looking for from a capital partner? You know, these are all things that should be a more measured approach to selling a business, especially if it's a high value business. And if you're going to extract what you would argue is maximum value, you owe it to yourself to be forward thinking about that. And again, to a degree, realistic about the multiples, the transaction value, the structure, and everything else that goes along with it. So hopefully this gives you a little bit more color into how we think about all these things. It's a lot, but I felt I owed it to many of you in the audience to kind of dig a little bit deeper than what we could do in a limited number of words on a couple of pages. And if I've done that, then mission accomplished for the day. As I started out saying, I want to extend a very, very sincere thanks to everyone who has been such a big advocate for ours. And sharing the show and really being part of a dynamic audience. I hear from a lot of you frequently, and that's kind of cool to hear as well. So thank you all for being a listener and a subscriber. We'll see you on the next episode.